This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. Kia ora, you're listening to Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu, and this is the first episode of Reserved Recommendations of Season 3. Seasons is just what I'm calling all of the shows that I managed to put together in a year. I figured it sounded clever, so I'm going to stick with it, even though I don't think actually the episode numbering on the podcast reflects that. Anyway.
Well, I can't change that.
Yeah, well, you could, but let's just maintain like two inconsistent levels of numbering for inexplicable reasons that only people who listen to this specific episode will get. The voice with me is my colleague Samuel, Sammy G, the content assistant here at Manawatu People's Radio. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. This has been an episode long in the making ever since you lent me a really dodgy pan and scan DVD to watch. I do kind of want to see that movie in widescreen now. But we can get into that later. The main topic is the video game movie adaptations specifically of the 1990s, which this is a show about great trash and difficult art, and this is definitely great trash that we're talking about. Video game movies, I think it's not a controversial opinion to have, are like famously not good. There are some exceptions which we can get into, or arguable exceptions, which we can get into.
I mean, they're getting better, but
yeah, I think, I mean, and that's a thing that we can talk about as well, the ways in which they're improving and maybe why they sucked so deeply for so long. But in their not goodness, there is a deep vein of fun, I think. Can you maybe explain what your entry into like video game movies was and why you have an affection for them?
Well, going back to the first one from the 1990s was the Super Mario Brothers video game
movie.
Yeah.
That's got Bob Hoskins and
John Leguizamo.
Who's the guy who plays the boss?
Dennis Hopper.
Yes, I knew it was someone who was like famous for being in better movies.
Yep. Slash being a bad guy in general.
So. Yeah. In real life, a very strange and unpleasant person, I believe, as well.
Haven't met him personally.
No,
but
well, he's dead. You've missed your shot. So what impact did, like, were you a Nintendo Mario kid to start off with, or was it just the kind of cultural force of Mario that had you interested in the movie?
Yeah, well, friends had Nintendos, and so I kind of got to like watch people playing it. And there was a TV show I remember watching called Video Power, which was half video game tips and cheats and stuff, and then like half cartoon based on like all these other video game characters that came together to form like the Power Team. And so, yeah, just between playing it at friends' places and watching that, just, yeah, video games kind of became a thing.
And what was like? What was the impact of the 90s movie for you? Because I understand, like, I have, this is one of the ones which I haven't actually seen. Because I was never a Nintendo kid. I was a Commodore 64 kid, and I went straight from Commodore 64 to like games for Windows 3.1 and DOS, bypassing consoles entirely until about the like PlayStation 2 kind of era. I understand that it was roundly panned on its release and was like a phenomenally expensive bomb, but what did you think of it?
As a kid, seeing it at the cinema, just fun. Like, yeah. Because I would have been, what year was that? It came out in 1993, so I would have been about six. So it was like, yeah, within those first couple of like movies that I would have seen like at the cinema.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's partly just like the entire experience of going to the cinema as a little kid, particularly in the 90s when, you know, TVs were, to put it bluntly, like completely rubbish. Even if you had a big TV, what was the resolution of standard TV? It was like 640 by 480 or worse. 640 by 480 was computer monitors. For like Windows 3.1, and TVs were worse than that. So yeah, it was a massive
not
step
really
up. Yeah. And so you didn't have the sort of canon concerns or anything like that. You weren't, no.
I mean, I don't remember there being much of a backstory unless it was like something in the packaging that had like a story about why has the princess run away and, you know, why am I fighting these turtle people? So missed all that. So just going into the movie and just enjoying what was presented. And
yeah, I mean, the thing about Mario is that even by the 90s, the character was such a cultural force that you could just like I knew what the premise of Mario games was, and as I say, I was not a Nintendo kid. I never had a Nintendo, and the people who had consoles who I went and visited as a small child were all Sega kids, which I think is a UK versus rest of the world split. Like, I think Sega had a bit more market dominance there, but not sure. So like, I knew more about Sonic to the extent that I knew anything about anything, but even I could have told you roughly what the premise of a Mario game is.
Plumber finds princess, tick.
Yeah. Jump on turtle, find princess.
Ooh, mushrooms.
And the movie, you know, at least does that in my understanding.
Yes. Like in terms of actual things from the game, the bombs make an appearance at quite an important moment, which is nice. The Goombas are in there in a weird kind of way. Yoshi makes an appearance in another weird kind of way. Yeah, it's – there were some elements of source material, but then they'd lots of artistic license and yeah.
Yeah, so my intro to video game movies was the 1990 – I'm just going to flick up the Wikipedia tab – the 1995 Mortal Kombat movie. So that was me like going to the movies by my own self, spending my own money at the age of 14 and going to see that in defiance of my like no violence in video games mum. I had a hell of a good time with that because I kind of feel like it's the rare example of one of these movies that completely got what the source material was about. It was just like unnecessarily violent fight with colorful contestants and a sort of generally kind of like 13, 14-year-old sense of like humor and aesthetics. And it just – I feel like it kind of nailed it. The 90s techno theme music didn't hurt. I don't know if you went to like all ages dance parties. They were a thing in Dunedin. I'm guessing they were a thing everywhere, like the blue light rave type things.
I went to a few blue light discos. Yeah.
The like we understand that you 13-year-olds would rather be going to an actual dance party because this town is known for them, and there would be illicit drugs and things, and you would get up to get to stay up until sunrise. But instead, we're going to do this all ages one for you type events.
In a controlled.
Yeah, that went on. I mean, they definitely had that kind of tone because they were very like happy hardcore and that kind of thing. The Mortal Kombat theme was an inescapable part of those kind of things. Like you would always hear the Mortal Kombat theme playing on a dance floor for at least like 3-4 years, if not longer.
Somewhere in my home, I have the actual Mortal Kombat soundtrack, so on CD.
Yeah, it was a hell of a soundtrack for a 90s movie. I can't remember anything else that's on it.
But the main theme was
like, yeah. I remember it was good, and it was like right in the vogue for techno songs where you just yell a thing in the like breakdown. Ecuador. I can't remember any other examples now, but I remember there were other ones where they just like they had a thing and they did it for a while and they stopped and they yelled a word and then they went back to it. Anyway, you probably just had to be there.
So, I'm just thinking of the Ghostbusters theme song now, which is, yeah.
Although the Ghostbusters had like more words rather than just Ghostbusters. Anyway, the place I was going is I maintain my affection for the Mortal Kombat movie, despite having not seen it for a long time. And Metacritic ratings and Rotten Tomatoes ratings I see looking on Wikipedia are not that great, although it looks like it financially did the best out of the 90s crop by a long, long stretch, which is good for New Line, I guess. Do you still have affection for the Super Mario Brothers movie? Like, is it just nostalgia? Have you rewatched it? Like, do you feel like it does an interesting thing?
I haven't watched it in a few years, but I think I will always have that kind of nostalgia lens for that one. And being a fan of John Leguizamo, so
yeah,
he can do no wrong.
No, and I mean, you know, Bob Hoskins is one of those kind of great. He's British, wasn't he? British character actors who kind of is just fun to watch in anything as well. Excellent. So
I just remembered the other reason why I like that movie so much. I had a super crush on Samantha Mathis, who played Princess Daisy. So
yes, yeah. Well, look, it's hard to overstate the power of something like that. I think there were a generation of. Let's be completely correct about this. There are a generation of people who are attracted to women who had a deep experience with Jennifer Connelly in The Labyrinth. That was, you know, like if you were the right age at the right time, then it was a thing. And I'm sure there are modern movies that do the same thing. For, you know, newer generations.
Well, they say Jennifer Connelly, but it was actually all about Bowie.
Well, so, you know, The Labyrinth, we're getting off track because it's not at all related to movies, but The Labyrinth is like a movie kind of about, amongst other things, figuring out sexuality and sexual identity. And I think Bowie is inspired casting for precisely that reason, because he was also hitting just the right age for Jareth to be like – if you rewatch it, and I think this is deliberate, he's kind of predatory in a way that I think is quite deliberate. He's not just sort of the sad fairy king, goblin king. There's an unpleasant edge there that I think was on purpose and just kind of skated over child me's head because there were like crystal balls and throwing babies around and stuff.
and magic dance.
Anyhow, The movie that you gave me to watch as a contributor to this conversation was the movie adaptation of the Double Dragon series, which is it's truly fascinating because it's I would hesitate to say that it's good, but it's really enthusiastic. And like Double Dragon as a video game series is incredibly shallow as far as backstory goes. It's like girl kidnap, beat up man, and there is literally nothing more to it than that. The only reason that it's called Double Dragon is because you could play it two player, but they construct this enormous, complicated like. Hyper cyberpunk setting for the
New Angeles.
Yeah, exactly.
In 2007.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm going to have to do. I don't know if I'm going to have to do it. I like the idea of doing a an episode on failed apocalypses. You know, Neon Genesis Evangelion happened in 2016, I think. The first Blade Runner was in like 2009, I think. It's not it's a while ago, but not that long ago. Yeah, 2007, hyper cyberpunk. The second Blade Runner is only like, yeah, it's only like 27 years away now.
Are we going to get there?
No, there's something there, but, that, so how did you come across this artifact? Because that was one that I was entirely unaware existed.
From memory, I first saw the movie on Sky Movies. It was just like a random thing that popped up, and then it kind of like just ate away in like the back of my head, like I need to find that on DVD so I can watch it again. And then I think I was working at the warehouse in 2005, and it was in the DVD bin, and I'm just like, well, that's mine now.
And
purchased it.
Yeah. Tellingly, as I said at the start, it's a pan and scan cut. They've for people not familiar with the lingo, what that means is that they've cropped an original widescreen release so it'll display on an old-fashioned CRT. I think that's 4:3 aspect ratio with no black bars at the top and bottom. And the way they do that is by just deciding arbitrarily where the
focal point should be
and keeping the frame there and just chopping the edges off. And looking at the amount of money that went into that movie, I'm not looking at the budget, but just my memory of what it looks like. It's not a cheap looking thing. Mm-hmm. So it was clearly, you know, properly theatrically released, and it's just been butchered like that for presumably VCR, and then they used exactly the same version for the DVD release without changing anything. Which tells you what happened to it when it got released. So with that one, the thing that strikes me about it is that, firstly, it's not cheap. You know, I have gone on to watch some movie adaptations of video games where clearly they are like transparent cash grabs and the absolute minimum of effort was put in. Assassin's Creed, and I mean, you know, money was spent to do a thing, but there was not a lot of effort, it doesn't feel like. But this is an incredibly, like, high effort. The Neo Angeles
season. New Angeles, yeah.
It looks like lush. There's hundreds of extras. There's crazy prosthetics.
Graffiti everywhere.
Like massive, weird cyberpunk props. Like a lot of work went into this thing that just kind of sank without trace. Is that the thing that kind of hooked you and meant that you felt like you had to track it down, or?
No, it was for Double Dragon. It was entirely Robert Patrick's performance. So he played the bad guy, Kogoshuko.
Who's, I think, invented for the movie, because I'm not this is where my lore starts to fall to bits for Double Dragon, because there isn't any. But my memory is that it's just like a bad guy, like the boss of the gang that you fight at the end of the game. I don't think that he had like even a name or anything. Maybe by Double Dragon 2, they deepen the lore.
I remember the cartoon being on like Saturday mornings, and like the big villain in that was the Shadow Master. And so I kind of like in my head just kind of put those two things together.
It wouldn't surprise me actually if the movie drew from the cartoon, which is a thing that I'm not surprised to find existed, because kind of everything got a cartoon adaptation at that point in time, but I didn't know about.
The Double Dragon one.
Yeah. So, like, were you a pre-existing Robert Patrick fan?
No. I recognized him from seeing, like, ads on TV for Terminator 2 and just
For people who don't remember actors' names, he's like the evil Terminator in Terminator 2. He's Mr. Liquid Metal.
Yeah, Mr. Walk Through Prison Bars and get shot and heal himself and yeah.
So. Yeah, and he does give a very like particular performance in that movie, because it's a really weird tone where they're trying to do this sort of like hyper-violent, high-stakes, scary cyberpunk thing, but they're also trying to like kind of pull off a 90s cartoon vibe at the same time. I remember one of the like side plots is about holding one of the henchmen hostage and feeding him spinach
until
until he decides to join the, and like Bobo Bobo is just like something that a Japanese person typed into into the name field for an anonymous boss in one of the games, and then they
took on a life of its own.
They turn him into a whole character. It's like a Bobson Dugnut kind of. If you're not familiar with Bobson Dugnut, look up Bobson Dugnut. It's there's a thing floating around the internet of all of the names of American baseball players that were generated for a baseball game on, I think, the Nintendo, but by a Japanese person who didn't really know what American names were like. And so they're all called things like Bobson Dugnut and Sleeve McDykel. It's great. It's neat. But Bobo is very much that kind of a name. Having found it on DVD, was it everything you hoped and dreamed?
I remembered parts of it pretty vividly, and then I'm just starting to like make connections in my brain at the moment. It also kind of reminds me of the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. From the 90s?
It's got a similar vibe.
The whole street gang kind of.
In retrospect, I think probably what was happening, and I didn't realize this because I didn't watch the actual movie until much, much later, is that all of these 90s kids properties were riffing on Warriors.
Yeah.
Except that, like, none of the kids who they were targeted at would have been allowed to see the Warriors. So it's like all of these people presumably watched the Warriors when they themselves were teenagers, and then like put that into their thing that they were making.
It's like an inside joke to themselves. It's like one day these kids will get it.
Which this is a digression, but I have three daughters, and as a result, I watched an awful lot of the Barbie movies. And by the modern day, the Barbie movies get weird and meta. And there is a – I can't remember what it's called, but it's like digital Barbie or something like that. The premise is like Barbie gets sucked into video game world or the internet or something. And In that one, the villains start doing Warriors jokes. Like, they do the, like, clinking bottles finger, like, come out to play thing in order to, like, intimidate people. And that was a very deep cut for Barbie. I was stunned and amazed at that one. Also, the Double Dragon movie has a very baby Alyssa Milano.
Yes.
Which my dates aren't clear enough to know if she was an attempt to add star power or if that was an early job for her.
Well, she was in Who's the Boss in the 80s. So, and was it Embrace of the Vampire?
Is that
like another movie that she did?
Embrace is. I'm going to look that up. You fill time. I'm going to look that up. Is Embrace, because I have a feeling that Embrace of the Vampire is a very particular thing, and I want to know if Embrace of the Vampire from 2013. Oh no, it's a remake. Oh no, there was a right. I want the 1995 one. Thank you.
So I'm pretty sure
some of that on TV. It was like a penthouse movie, wasn't it? Like it was something where they were like, they were trying to imply that it was going to be porn and then it never quite was.
Never crossed that line.
Yeah, that's, oh, wow.
Despite my love of vampire movies, that's one that I haven't seen yet.
So. Yeah, I think you have just reminded me of a thing that I had forgotten. I think I watched about half of it and gave up when it was on TV once. Wow, there you go. Yep, cool, excellent.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Oh wow, yep. Very cool. Very cool. Well, look, with that, it might be time to take a break, and we will be back right after this.
Cold shower and a beverage.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.
All right, we are back. You're listening to Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast made through Manawatu People's Radio. Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu with the support of New Zealand On Air. This is a show about great trash and difficult art. And today I am talking to Sammy G, content assistant here at Manawatu People's Radio, about the video game adaptations of the 90s in particular. And I think, I guess the thing, and I'm about to pitch this as a statement rather than a question, which is not a good way to do interviews. So do as I say, not as I do. But one of the things, I suppose, about 90s movies in general, and this carries over to the video game adaptations, is that they're at an interesting crossover point in terms of effects, because they're at a point where CG is like starting to become a thing, but it costs a lot of money to do it well. And so a lot of stuff is still practical, and there's a very particular look to that. And there's a period after that kind of sort of mid-90s era where the cost of CG drops dramatically, and it is very bad for a while. I think if you need proof of that, Google an image of The Rock as the Scorpion King and prepare to be truly horrified by a ghastly facsimile of a human form.
End of The Mummy Returns, when he first makes his kind of appearances.
Yeah. And it goes through a period of really not being very good at all. And it takes a sec before people kind of work out some restraint and become more subtle in using it. And also before people have access to enough computing power to really do a good job and make things look genuinely nice. Because, I mean, you do get to a point where I'm thinking of the Final Fantasy movie, which is only 2001, actually, but they spent an enormous amount of money on computing power for that. There is a point where it starts looking half decent, and all of these movies that we're talking about, which is it's a pretty narrow slice of the video game movie pie, but they all kind of sit in that era. So, for example, in Mortal Kombat,
Reptile
and the portals. Although Reptile, my understanding is that Reptile was partly hand drawn or computer assisted rather than pure CGI. I might be wrong about that. Reptile is a little like in the actual games, he is exactly the same ninja as the two other ninjas. He's just green instead of yellow or blue. But in the movie, he's a weird little reptile monster that jumps out of a statue.
And then into a corpse, which he then like reanimates.
Oh, I forgot that he reanimated a corpse. My memory of him was that, because I learned a bit of trivia about the movie from my dad, of all people, which is because he read in some magazine article that the guy who played Liu Kang in that movie.
Robin Shaw?
Yeah, he was talking in an interview about what it was like to do it, and he was saying that the fight against Reptile was one of the things that he had to do most takes on, because when he went to do – like he grabs the little reptile monster, and when he went to do that, his instinct was to grab with his fingers spread. You know, like if you try to grab just the air, you spread your fingers. And they kept saying to him, if you do that, you're going to cost us like $10 million a finger or something, because we're going to have to animate the gaps in between your fingers when you do it. So he had to train himself to do a like closed hand grab on this thing that wasn't there. Anyway.
I'm just picturing like that whole like behind the scenes thing of like, with nothing or.
Yeah. You know, that's not new. You can go back to like
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Who Framed Roger Rabbit, or earlier Jason and the Argonauts, you know, that whole fight where he's fighting stop motion skeletons. The whole thing is he just had to be, you know, absolutely perfect about where he was going so that they could add the skeletons in later. This thing that I pitched, as I say, as a statement when it should have been a question is, like that's period of transition between like purely practical effects and the period when CGI got rubbish before it got good. That does give these movies a particular look. Do you feel like that's part of your affection for them?
Not on rewatching things. like they are still some of my favorite films. And as you were, talking about the CGI thing, I just kept having visions of the 90s Spawn film and how they animated the cape and it was all CG'd and The 90s were a special time for CG.
they were a very special time for CG. To be honest, my sole memory of that Spawn movie, because I watched the Spawn animated series because I was watching the particular late night cartoons bracket on New Zealand TV, which had Spawn, Aeon Flux, and something else that I can't remember. It might have been – there was like a slice of life show about 20-somethings in the big city or something. It might have been
that. The real life?
Yeah, maybe, but it was animated.
Or the –
I think like it, I remember it having an art style that was reminiscent of like Doug and the Rugrats, like that kind of particular 90s cartoon moment, but it was like aimed at 20 somethings, and it was a kind of slice of life thing about
that's going to eat 20 somethings
in the big city. You can picture it in your head now, right? It's like
one that I could think of was Daria.
Yeah, it was Daria adjacent as well, but like pitched older than Daria. Mm. Anyway, I was watching that block, and they had the Spawn cartoon series.
It's like 9:30. Yeah.
Yeah, I watched that because I wanted to watch Aeon Flux, which was on afterwards. And on the strength of having watched some of that, I watched the Spawn movie, and all I remember about the Spawn movie is his codpiece biting someone who tries to knee him in the crotch. That's my entire memory of that movie, is that someone tries to knee him in the nuts and his codpiece bites them in the knee. Which, I don't know, that might be a sufficient advertisement for a movie for you. I don't know. I guess there's an elephant in the room in terms of 90s video game movies, which we have not discussed. Have you strong feelings about Street Fighter, the movie featuring Jean-Claude Van Damme and Raul Julia and presumably other people? Oh, I forgot Kylie Minogue was in it.
She was Cammy,
Yep.
Who else was in it? Those are like the three or four that I...
Yeah, it was a fairly star-studded cast. Like they were clearly trying to make the lightning strike. Let me just check if it was after or before. It was before Mortal Kombat.
Yeah,
so,
94.
For some reason, I thought it was after. Do you have strong feelings about it? I understand it's not one that I've like. It's a movie that I've probably watched, but I've never watched all the way through. Like, I've watched so many bits of it that I know it more or less, but I don't think I've ever watched the entire thing in a sitting. I understand it is beloved of fans of Raul Julia for him just eating the scenery as so M. Bison.
So good.
Yeah, because my introduction to Raul Julia was as Gomez in the Addams Family movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, seeing a trailer for Street Fighter and then see him as, like, M. Bison, and I remember playing Street Fighter on my brother borrowed a Super Nintendo, and my instant watch was Bison. So
my best friend when I was that age, like 13, 14, well, I had two friends with whom I had strong Street Fighter memories. There was a guy at my school whose parents – he was Chinese, and his parents owned a Chinese restaurant where, like, you know, where the back half is a Chinese restaurant, the front half is a fish and chip shop. You can, like, walk around the fish and chip shop counter and get into the Chinese restaurant. And they had Street Fighter 2 Turbo, and they could get coins back if you marked them with Vivid. And so, like, the company would give back 20-cent coins that had been drawn on in Vivid. And so we used to take coins out the till and mark them and play, like, endless Street Fighter 2 Turbo, and I nearly got better than completely rubbish. But also my best friend, he had an Amiga 500. I think he might have had the next one that almost nobody had, and thus there was nothing developed specifically for it. Anyway, he had an Amiga, and we played the Amiga port of Street Fighter 2 constantly, which, pro tip, had the stun mechanic was broken. So every character had a couple of moves which would stun someone if you hit them with it, like, twice. And so we used to have these endless games of, like, I worked out what it was with Dalsim, and he worked out what it was with Chun-Li. And we just had, like, these endless, like, who can stun lock the other person first? Because you could also stun someone who was already stunned, because they just – back in the old days, they did not port games well. No. You kids of today, you do not know.
You have no idea.
You do not know what a truly bad port is like. So yeah, the Street Fighter 2 was like it was kind of genre defining as far as the 2D fighter thing, which was like the fish and chip shop video game of choice, because it was a like exactly enough time to wait for your chips, and you'd spend like $1.20 coins.
Just fighting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, the game was pretty the movie was like, it was a massive franchise to try and cash in on. So did you go see that one at the movies when it came out?
No, that's one that I saw on Sky Movies at home. Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, I think I got it via like, you know, the kind of sleepover party where you watch a DVD, or it would have been a video probably, and always like came in partway through it. Aside from Raul Julia, thoughts?
Super cheesy. Super cheesy. And like, in regards to the source material, I guess it's not too bad.
Yeah, yeah. I think it it fared better critically than the standalone Chun-Li movies that they tried to make later, which kind of missed the point in several different ways, despite being kind of more modern. This is normally a thing I get into at the end, but did you ever see the OVA for Street Fighter?
I feel like my brother had it, and I don't think I watched it start to finish myself. But I remember like what I saw of it, I thought was awesome, and yeah.
It kind of re-got me back into Street Fighter after having lost interest in it. Kind of basically purely on the way that it characterized Ryu, I decided that Ryu was going to be my life goals for a little bit. utter nonsense, but again, kind of got the vibe of the game in the way that I kind of feel like the live action movie kind of
totally
didn't.
Totally missed the mark. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I think, which is weird because it's not like action movies, which are just a sequence of fights between people with different fighting styles, like weren't a thing. There's a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie.
Street Fighter.
No, it's called something like really basic and on the nose.
Kickboxer.
It's like the tournament or the cup or the trial or something like that. Like, it's just the challenge, maybe. But it's basically exactly what you would want a Street Fighter movie to be, I guess, minus the super moves. It's like he winds up through some plot reason that's not important in a fighting tournament where there are people from all over the world who all use their own like indigenous fighting style. So there's like a capoeira guy, and there's a Scottish guy who just does like boxing, but barefoot in a kilt for some reason. Yeah, I can't remember what it was called, but it was.
Do you remember what year it came out?
Not the faintest idea.
Because I have IMDb open as we speak. I was just trying to like.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, but also, you know, the kickboxer movies, there were a bunch of Bruce Lee's movies going back to the 70s that were just excuses to set up fights that Bruce Lee thought would be kind of interesting to film. Like, what if I fight a real tall guy who's a basketball player?
Game of Death?
Yeah, I think so. What if I fight Chuck Norris? Like, they're all there. You know, the plot is just an excuse for what if this kind of fight? So it's weird that that they couldn't just do that. I guess that's the thing that always baffles me about bad video game adaptations, is that the video game is often already riffing on a kind of movie. So I don't quite see why you don't just make that kind of movie.
It's what we paid for when we got the tickets.
Yeah, yeah, like. Yeah. You know, this is getting outside the 90s scope, but I mentioned it earlier, the Assassin's Creed movie. Like, Assassin's Creed is about sneakiness and parkour, and there is lore, but the lore is complete nonsense. So you should, like, the point of the lore is that it doesn't, it's not, I don't know if it's the point of it, but like the experience of playing Assassin's Creed is if you think about why anyone is doing anything, it will fall apart because none of it makes any sense. And the modern day protagonist is just a vehicle to get to the actually interesting person in the past. And then in the...
Which is basically just the Matrix.
Yeah, yeah. And then in the movie adaptation, they had almost no parkour, almost no sneaking, and an inordinate amount of time spent with the modern person who was as uninteresting as they usually are. And it's deeply frustrating because I don't understand why you would make any of those decisions.
Spend more time in the universe that we want. And
yeah, yeah, no, exactly. I mean, similarly with the Max Payne movie, you know, Max Payne is just like more over the top than usual crime noir with like there's just the hint that there might be something supernatural happening maybe, but it's just that's purely because they give the background characters mythological names.
And the drug was called Valkyrie?
Yeah. I mean, it was a bright green fluid called V, which the game came out about the point where energy drinks became widely available, and it was a lot of fun that you were dealing with people crazed by a bright green fluid called V.
But again, society now, yeah.
the movie got into this weird deep lore that it made up about the drug giving you literal access to another dimension with like flying monsters that attack people or something. It was,
remember the angel bit at the end.
Yeah, which comes from like it's a deranged monologue that you hear a guy give before a boss fight in the game. There's no indication that there are angels or anything. There's just a guy who shouts about the flesh of fallen angels, and then you have an annoyingly long boss fight with him.
I'm having like crossover flashbacks to like Constantine, and it's all just getting quite messy up there.
Yeah. Yes, Constantine is another unrelated kettle of fish. The cool thing about Constantine is that Constantine, because he is a literal wizard whose magic is very like improvise and see what happens, and maybe we're messing with alternate realities or maybe we're not. In one of the later Constantine comics, someone refers to like, oh, I thought you had black hair, because canonically in the comics he was originally drawn blonde to look like Sting in Quadrophenia. His look has sort of evolved from there. But yeah, they talk about, I thought you had black hair, and it's like, oh, something weird there for a second. I don't know how that happened. So
Keanu did good.
We're getting close to time, and I guess I'm struggling for a kind of final conclusion to land on. And I guess it's just that enthusiasm for what you're doing is very infectious. You know, like in the course of this conversation, the movies that we've reflected on fondly rather than that have been painful memories are the ones where people seemed to genuinely be enjoying what they're doing, even if what they're doing is kind of unhinged.
Raul Julia.
yeah. No, I mean, you know, that was I'm doing this so I'm in something that my grandkids will watch. And I'm going to have as much fun as possible because I think he knew by that stage that he was not well and that was going to be basically his last movie. So he was just, you know, what have I got to lose? I'm going to
go out with a bang.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know about everybody else who was in Street Fighter, what they thought they were doing. But similarly, like, there's a lot of gusto on display in Mortal Kombat. You know, no one is half-assing it. I don't think.
Christopher Lambert as Raiden was like.
Yeah, yeah. Fun. I mean, like. A bizarre casting choice because he's like canonically a Japanese lightning god. And they make him Christopher Lambert cannot not be French in the same way that Sean Connery has the Sean Connery voice and nothing else.
Your soul is mine.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right. It was an inspired weird casting choice. I think my promo art for this episode is going to be a picture of Christopher Lambert with some very 90s lightning on his eyeballs. So I guess if you're looking for a grand overarching moral for this episode, it's like have fun doing the thing, and then at least if it's bad, it'll be a fun kind of bad to watch.
Also, what goes on film cannot be erased.
No, it can't. But, you know, like I think most of these people came out of these things just fine, actually. You know, Bob Hoskins went on to be the much beloved Bob Hoskins. Alyssa Milano went on to be on
Charmed.
And, you know, thinking about paychecks, I'm not willing to debate the artistic merits of Charmed. I haven't watched enough of it.
I can't remember. Scott Wolf, who was also in Double Dragon, was in Party of Five.
Yep.
But I can't remember if that came first or if it was Double Dragon into Party of Five.
Oh, Double Dragon's 94. I don't know when Party of Five came out. Yeah, I will leave that for somebody else to speculate on.
Also 94. So.
Oh, right. Okay, so that was contemporaneous. He was, you know, there was things you could have watched both at once. So I guess, you know, we're not talking about anyone having their careers destroyed.
Ruined by being in these things.
Jean-Claude Van Damme continued to be Jean-Claude Van Damme. Christopher Lambert continued to be Christopher Lambert.
Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, he Dennis Hopper'd all over the place. I think Speed is after that. So, you know, I don't think there's always that ethical debate when you go to enjoy something that you know is going to be not good, about, you know, what harm was done by its badness, or what harm was done in its creation as part of its badness. It's one of the debates about The Room is that Tommy Wiseau was notoriously awful to everyone involved in the creation of that movie, and it kind of taints it. But I don't think any of these things have this kind of story attached. So if you have the patience for them, you're not sinning by indulging.
Yeah.
So I have two things I like to do by way of wrapping these episodes up. The first one is, do you have specific recommendations if people have enjoyed the concept of the thing that we're talking about? You know, are there particular movies out of the selection that you would recommend? Are there other later video game adaptation movies that you would recommend to contrast?
I mean, if you're not too attached to the Super Mario Brothers video games, then go watch the movie, and just have fun with it. Just have fun with it. Modern, the first one that comes to my head is the Sonic the Hedgehog movie.
Yeah, I heard good things about that when I talked to Stuart Drake a while back about Sonic as a franchise. Yep. I would recommend the 90s Mortal Kombat. I don't know anything about Mortal Kombat Annihilation, which was the sequel. Yes, that sounds like the thing. I do hear good-ish things about the modern Mortal Kombat. Yeah, the modern Mortal Kombat movie. In terms of, I guess, newer things, I thought that Silent Hills movie adaptation was unfairly maligned when it came out.
I saw that six times at the movies, which was like...
Like it's not a direct translation of Silent Hill, but Silent Hill, there's no real connection between the good Silent Hills and each other. It's just like a vibe, really. And the town of Silent Hill, but the town of Silent Hill is more of a vibe than anything. And so
it's
the
based on Centralia in, I think it's Pennsylvania.
Yeah, but it's also like it's also just a hack for the limited power of the original PlayStation hardware. They couldn't render the level of detail that they wanted and have a good draw distance, so they introduced the fog to conceal it, and it turned out to be really good.
Atmospheric horror, yeah.
I understand that the Resident Evil movies have kind of turned into their own thing by this stage that people like for itself, but I haven't watched any of them.
There's a new one, Welcome to Raccoon City, which I think kind of like reboots the whole kind of thing and starts back at the beginning.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it yet. It's on my list.
I would also really recommend, if you have tolerance for a mild level of the like implied rape threat thing that is kind of endemic to anime from the 90s, the Street Fighter OVA does a very good job of catching the spirit of Street Fighter, and you get a lot of like, oh, hey, it's that guy moments. Like you get to see Blanka for 30 seconds having a fight because he's a character that's impossible to actually incorporate into the story. But, you know, you get to see him do the move where he zaps someone and it's cool.
His relationship with Delsim in the live action movie was interesting.
I mean, characters that have precisely zero to do with one another. But I guess the one I have most curiosity about out of the list that I looked at it in Wikipedia is Wing Commander. Nothing leads me to believe that it's good, but I'm kind of fascinated by the way in which it's bad. But I haven't seen it. The last thing that I like to do is give you an opportunity to plug your shit. You are, of course, a broadcaster on Manawatu People's Radio in your own right. Pitch your show.
So I co-host Pipe Bombs and Headlocks here on NPR. It is a hour-long show about pro wrestling. We look at the New Zealand professional wrestling scene as well as sometimes stuff happening overseas. And
Yeah, I mean, look, I have done an episode on professional wrestling with Ben Caldwell from What Have You Done For Us Lately. It's a fascinating world, and the New Zealand scene is its own interesting thing. Also, we should do another episode sometime talking about wrestling spin-off movies because there is a deep vein of strange stuff there. Fantastic. Thank you very much for coming on, Sam. Cheers.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes at npr.nz/show/reserved, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me on Twitter at Objective Realty, or you can follow the show on Facebook. And finally, Manawatu People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.